God damn it! Welcome back to Acid Horizon, the Fury podcast. And today, we are talking about The Economy of Damnation, St. Anselm of Canterbury, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Sadia Hartman on Debt, with guest Sean Kapaner. Sean joins us from an ongoing collaboration we have with the Mimbrous School, a para-academic outsider learning facility and institution, maybe, I'm not sure. Maybe I have to ask Colin about this. Go back to an episode of Colin to revisit the nature of members. But nonetheless, if you need some theory, they're here to give it for you at reasonable prices. And Sean joins us over from the Members School. Sean, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So today we're going to talk about this idea of damnation and how it relates to for going from theological concepts to political concepts and economic concepts. So just to start off, how did you get into this topic? And of course, we read one of your upcoming papers for this on the Fall of Angels, Economic Theology After the Middle Passage. Can you sort of tell us where this work came from? And also the wider work you're doing with Mimbrous too, because of course, this is one of the texts you're going to be reading as part of your History of Damnation course.
Yeah, so for me, this has been kind of a running... This is part of a project that I sort of that got off the ground in like 2011, 2012, really around Occupy initially, actually. And then I sort of realized I didn't have the resources to actually figure out the answers to my questions at the time. So it's been on the back burner and is sort of coming back into focus now. And at the time, so I was involved a bit in Occupy Los Angeles, as I'm sure your viewers are aware. One of the kind of things going on with Occupy was that it heavily inflected its critiques of capitalism through a critique of debt, very specifically. This idea that the kind of fundamental sort of power relations, contradictions, whatever you want to call them, really have to do with the debt relationship, at least in the contemporary situation. And really, so this sort of emerged out of two things. One was kind of a sense that there was something obviously right about that framing, but something about that framing that kept hitting a wall. And for people who were around Occupy or people who have been around organizing contexts that sort of sprang out of it, one of the obvious ways that hit a wall was around questions of race, right? It's very easy to set up a framing of a question about the politics of debt that ends up being sort of like, oh, well, creditors bad, debtors good, and all debtors are the same. And this both isn't actually what we saw on the ground. And the fact that we didn't see this on the ground meant that trying to tackle, say, questions about how do you defend against foreclosures, how do you do things like this, really didn't jive well with people who were really kind of encountering their own debt as a credit opportunity. Debt did not mean the same things to all people who held it. So partly there's a live political question. And then partly, like all religious studies scholars I know, I got deeply fucked up by religion at some point in my past. I grew up in a very conservative evangelical sort of social context. And I like to joke that scholars of Christianity are almost universally people who got fucked up by Christianity at some point, whereas scholars of Islam are almost universally people who got fucked up by Christianity at some point, and scholars of Judaism are almost universally people who got fucked up by Christianity at some point. So I needed to figure out what was going on with that. And it, as someone with a background in that, I couldn't look away from the fact that these seemed to be the same question. That the language of Christianity really is just the language of debt. So eventually, with grad school being a more expensive way to do therapy, I encountered people like Nietzsche, Deleuze, who had something to say about this. But you don't need Nietzsche or Deleuze to notice this. This is just kind of right there on the sticker with Christianity. So there's this question about, there are these two questions, and are they the same question? And how are they the same question, if so? And why? Why do these two things keep inflecting one another? And so that's sort of the origins of the project.
Let's get into it, because the sort of the main sort of theological aspect you're tackling here is the theory of atonement, essentially the theory of what does Jesus's death somehow achieve. And looking at Anselm is coming in with his own theory of atonement, goes against a ransom Fury of Atonement, and basically brings a new way of thinking about the debt humans have to their creator, but also just the literal economy in terms of where the term comes from, you know, the management of the house, management of the house of creation itself. How does Anselm bring forth a new theory of debt in a Fury of Atonement, and what's he responding to when he's doing this?
Right. So there's a kind of classic way of sort of dividing up the field of the history of Christian atonement theories, which is in a lot of ways best said as kind of this, the theory of why did we need a Jesus in the first place, right? Why do you need something like a God-man, which is literally the title of the book, right? Why a God-man? What makes that necessary? What's the problem to which a Jesus is an answer? And from more or less Paul, the answer to that question seems to be debt and slavery. In some way, we are in debt, and in some way, our debt has enslaved us to our sin. The question is how? As you note, Anselm is responding to what for several hundred years was sort of the dominant way of attempting to square this circle, which is what's called a ransom theory of atonement, which basically says, okay, what's the problem that Jesus solves? Well, the problem is that you are in debt to a creditor, and that creditor is the devil. The devil loaned you something, that something is his authority, sin, and by taking it, you accepted something that you actually couldn't pay for. And since you couldn't make the payments, now you're stuck. And in Roman law, there's this phenomenon called addiction, which is actually where we get the word addiction today. Our medical discourse around addiction is a debt metaphor all the way down, which has its own kind of interesting connotations. The thing, what an addict is it's someone who's been handed over, addict, literally handed to someone else by a legal judgment. So what's going on here is that you're in debt to a creditor and you can't make your payments, and the creditor takes you to the judge, and the judge says, okay, well, if you can't pay him, and if you don't have enough wealth that the creditor can take it out of your estate, the creditor can take it out of you by taking you. So this is the most, to listeners who aren't familiar with kind of the ins and outs of ancient Roman law, this is probably most similar in modernity to what you'd think of as like indentured servitude, right? And this is important because it's both is and is conceived of as a form of slavery, but it's a term limited form of slavery. Addiction is both in some way your fault, but is also in some way sort of the creditor's fault, which gets into some of the moral questions around addiction and the way it actually ends up getting outlawed in the Middle Ages. But so you owe the devil, you can't pay the devil. The devil seizes you as collateral and you need to get out. But how do you get out? The debt is getting out of control. The interest keeps expanding further than you can keep up with it. So your work for your creditor is not paying off your debt. It's barely making interest payments. And you need someone to buy you out. And that's what God does. And so this is the ransom theory of atonement. It's a ransom in the sense that someone literally buys you out from a captor. And the coin they use to do it is Jesus. Jesus works for this because in the ransom theory, not Anselm's theory, because essentially Jesus is of infinite value because he's both God and man. So he's worth more than any guy. But he's also not owed to the devil. So he's not already part of the devil's debt. Now, the trick with the ransom theory of atonement and what makes it super weird is that it involves saying that God essentially deceives the devil. So God doesn't just pay the ransom and thus kind of get you off the hook. Because if he tried to do that, the devil wouldn't accept the payment because the devil wants you. What God does is God offers himself in human form as a person worth more than any, than all other people combined, and basically gets the devil to overstep his authority and claim this payment that isn't his to claim. And by doing so, the devil more or less accidentally breaks the terms of the original agreement. So there's a kind of trickster element to this story that by the early Middle Ages, Anselm is 11th century. I think he writes Cur Deus Homo and or Why a Godman in 1094 or something, 1093. I'm sure I say an exact date in the paper, but it's 10 somethings. This seems to be one of the main elements of the story that Christians are uncomfortable with because it makes God a liar. So there's a question about, okay, so this is weird. There's also another problem with this story, which is that it makes the devil seem like his authority was real. It makes him sort of a legitimate competitor to God. So Anselm comes along and goes like, okay, that can't be what's going on for both these reasons. These make God into something that it would be bad for God to be, and these make the devil into something that it would be bad for the devil to be. So what does he do? He says, okay, let's not think about this as debt slavery. Let's not think about this as addiction. Let's think about this as manorial servitude. So the legal terminology he uses kind of swaps back and forth between what we think of as like serfdom, where you're tied to the land, you're indebted to the land. And so you rent to a landlord who you also are partly the property of because you are part of the landlord's estate and you get sold with the estate, and partly kind of more classical models of slavery. So not debt slavery with this kind of term limited. There are things you can't do to a debt slave that you can do to a more traditional slave, because in theory, you have to hand the debt slave back. A debt slave is like a rented person in a certain kind of sense rather than an owned person. You have temporary ownership, and having temporary ownership means you have to be able to hand your property back at the end of the rental period in a way that's just not true of more traditional forms of slavery. So he's like, okay, no, we're not debt slaves. Exactly. We do owe debt because part of manorial rent is a debt. You owe the rent, and we're behind on that. But we're these manorial slaves or serfs. And that means that who is our creditor? It's not the devil. That's not the problem. You owe God. The problem is that you're behind on your payments, and one of the other slaves on the estate convinced you to run off with him, that other slave being the devil. And in so doing, you stole yourself. So you are stolen property and you're withholding rent. And that means, just like before, that you have a debt that you can never repay. Because even if you started paying tomorrow, so you return yourself to your owner and start making payments again on your creditor, the problem is that you owe your creditor everything. So you can never go back in time and pay what you didn't pay before. The interest on that will keep ballooning, and there's nothing you can do. So once again, the solution is a Godman. The solution is a coin in human form with infinite value that can pay your debt. Nietzsche puts this really well, actually. Like he really, I think, gets what's going on in this dynamic. And when Nietzsche talks about Christianity, you really should have Anselm in mind, I think, most of the time. Like that really is Anselm's model of atonement is sort of Nietzsche's image of like this. What did God do? God pays himself on his own behalf out of love for his debtor. Now, there are some obvious weird things with this because, okay, so if God is the one we owed, why does God need to pay himself? Why can't God just forgive our debts? Why does God need to pay himself with his own money? Like, what is that? And that ends up being the book, right? Like the book ends up being, okay, so we've solved this, the devil has real power problem by making it all God. That's a problem though, because that seems to mean that like God really, like God cares more about satisfying the debt than about us. How do we say that's not what's happening here? And in some sense, like the best way to understand why a Godman is like a several hundred page book attempting to answer the question of how this doesn't make God bad. Like how is it that God is not like obviously a predatory lender in this situation? So maybe that's the brief spiel about what they're doing. Not so brief at this point.
In terms of Anselm's solution to this, it kind of, I mean, this is the double bind, I think, that fleshes out a lot in your paper, which is God ends up having to essentially, because he's given humanity a debt which they cannot pay, he therefore has to buy them out of it on the basis that this act also redeems God and man at the same time, because otherwise God would be like, well, I've given you all this debt, and I'm the one that's given you that, and I know you can't pay it back, because that's kind of my thing as well, deciding that. So in order for me not to be a predatory lender, I have to buy you out. But then again, is that predatory nature not sublated? And I guess this is what you call the redemption machine or the damnation machine. And there's that additional aspect here, which we haven't brought up yet, which is that there are two types of debtor in this narrative. And this is where we get to the proper good old weird stuff of angelology.
Right.
So what is a fallen angel, and how does this relate to Anselm's argument?
Right. So Anselm spends way more of the book than you would think not talking about us, but talking about angels. The problem there is that, at least in theory, angels should be in the same situation as us. So if the problem is that we were given our lives and owe obedience and didn't give it and stole ourselves, and if that's what sin is, then that seems to be also kind of the basis for demonology, right? So demons in a kind of Latin Christian conception are just regular old angels who at the first moment of creation said, what do you mean my existence is entirely for worshiping you? Why wouldn't I want to do my own thing? And attempted to go off and do their own thing. Satan is special only in the sense that Satan is the angel who convinced all of the other angels who did this to do this. This is what makes him their kind of commander in chief, as it were. He's the first runaway slave, in a sense. He's the runaway slave who tells everyone else that running away is possible. Anselm then runs into this question of like, okay, so if there's this solution to this human debt problem, why the fuck is this not a solution for angels too? Like, why are demons just demons? Why can't demons turn to Christ? Why can't demons get saved? Like, why would that not be a thing? And to tell that story, Anselm has to tell a story about what exactly the mechanism is that makes one person's payment able to affect a payment for someone else. Why is one person able to pay someone else's debts? And the story Anselm has about this ends up being about kinship. It ends up being this idea that, oh, well, in some sense, debt is all about inheritance. It's all about relationships in which you inherit either money and credit or you inherit debt. And the reason Jesus can pay for us is Jesus is part of the same family. Jesus is directly related to every one of us because we're all sons and daughters of Adam, if you go back far enough. And so since he's part of the same family tree, his merit can be transferred to other members of the family tree, just like you can inherit and disinherit credit and debt. The problem is angels don't have this. Angels don't reproduce sexually. They don't have family lines. Each one was created unique for its own purpose. So like the kind of technical Latin terminology here is that like humans, angels all share a common natura or nature. So they share common angelness, much like we share a common humanness or humanity. What they don't share is a common genus, a common race, stock, line of descent. Genus is like a really weird loaded word in Latin that can mean a lot of things. But that always kind of carries this connotation of like patrimony, both in a quasi-biological sense and in a kind of economic sense at the same time, almost as if those are the same thing. Angels don't have this. They were all created one at a time, like once as their own thing for their own job. They don't have filial relationships to one another. And so they have no way to pass credit, debt, money. They have no economy between them in this specific sense of economy. They have an economy in the sense that they are part of God's household, but not in the sense that they are one another's kin. And so Anselm will say, okay, so to do this, you'd have to have an angel God, much like you have a human God, or a god man. You'd have to have a god angel. But even if you did that, it wouldn't work because the god angel would be no angel's family. And so anything that that angel did wouldn't reflect on other angels in the way what you do reflects on your family. Because of this, they're in a fundamentally different situation. We are sinners who, if we don't accept the payment made on our behalf, might be damned. They are just damned. There is no coming back from what they've done. And there's no coming back because they do not kind of sit in a sort of, there's a good slavery studies word for this. They're natally alienated. So if anyone's familiar with the work of Orlando Patterson, who's a sociologist of slavery, wrote a book called Slavery and Social Death, in which he argues kind of what's definitive of slavery is this condition that he calls social death, which he characterizes in terms of kind of being open to violence for no kind of pretextual reason other than already being socially dead, being generally dishonored, and being what he calls natally alienated. And I kind of read natal alienation as sort of the main ingredient here, because what makes the problem of slavery, as Orlando Patterson sets it up, is this problem of, oh, the only person with legitimate claims on you is your owner, which means that no, your family's claims on you, your friend's claims on you, like the various other claims someone could make on you can always be overridden by one person. You are cut off from the kinds of kinship claims that would let you play one kinship, like one responsibility against another responsibility in a certain kind of way. So angels are natally alienated in exactly this sense. And in a way that's like so on the nose, like a slavery metaphor, that it's like, And this is what makes them not us, as Ansel puts it.
Thank you so much. I'll open it up to Noah or Craig if you guys want to jump in.
Yeah, I just, you know, Sean, thanks again for coming on. The connection with, you know, what we've done at Members with things like Afro-pessimism with Teja and reading Orlando Patterson and these themes, you know, coming up so, as you say, explicitly on the nose in theology is rather curious. And so maybe you could give some context or explication of how we now read Anselm in theology generally in the wake of Atlantic slave trade and the post-emancipation, and perhaps, you know, help us understand, you know, one of the parts of your essay is on the debt relationship of slavery specifically. Why are we going to theology now even to discuss these topics, right? Because we've found out that it is just like on the nose and it's like very obvious, but what does this unlock for us? Maybe for Black studies, maybe for you, as you said, on the ground in the movement of dealing with debt and protesting debt and things like that. What are we getting from this, and what is this toolkit doing for us?
Yeah, so for me, there's kind of two parts to this. One has to do with sort of why turn to theology to think about political economic problems more generally, and then what is this kind of specific set of questions about damnation maybe allowing us to unlock? So on a general level, like I kind of think the reason to go to theology to think about these things because and how it makes us read theology differently. Has a lot to do with the fact that, so there's a level on which this is all very on the nose, and there's a level on which Anselm cannot be talking about Atlantic slavery because it just literally hasn't happened yet, right? That happens later between him and us. And so there's a way in which the kind of anachronism is the point, right? We look at this differently in retrospect. And part of the reason I think to look at this differently in retrospect has to do with what theology is and what economics is in to me, which is to say that in some sense what they both are is legitimation narratives. In some sense what they both are is a story about why is the fact that things are the way they are, if not good, at least unavoidable and inevitable. So it's not just why are things the way they are in kind of like a how did they come to be this way sense, but why are things the way they are? You wouldn't even want them to be different sense. That in some sense, that's the central question at stake in both disciplines, right? And in some ways, that's not a historical. I think that's not entirely a historical accident. There's a reason that there's this whole kind of history of talking about theology as economy that then becomes has these parallels with talking about economics as economy that have to do with this question of what an economy even is and how it is that the state of affairs around us gets justified. So one of the things I say in the paper that's really kind of clarified this for me is so people who have kind of been around the block of like, oh, I've seen all these kind of I'm not the first person to do right theology and economic stuff. This is kind of a well-worn thing. There's a whole kind of 2000s cottage industry around like economics. It means the management of the household, and that's the Trinity, right? Giorgio Gombin did like a bunch of stuff on this, like Marie Jose Monzan. But the trick is, it doesn't just mean the management of the household in Greek. It means the distributive law of the household. Part of what distributive law means is not the distribution of goods and services among people in the household, but the distribution of people in the household, or the distribution of positions in the household. In other words, so you read Aristotle's Politics, and the first book is about economics, and he's like, economics is, you know, the organization of the house. And what does that all end up being about? It's not about, like, there's some stuff about money and buying and selling, but the stuff about money and buying and selling is said in order to say, like, oh, like, this is a story about why it is that there are women, slaves, children, and men, and they all have a different reason for being in the household. And they belong where they are. Like that, in some ways, that's the argument of book one. Like all the stuff about money in Aristotle's economic theory is a way of getting to that. Why are people where they are in a social order? Why do they belong where they are in a social order? And so there's a sense in which that's what economics is. And that's also what theology is. And there's a way in which looking at theology, now that theology is not kind of the lingua franca for justification in our society, like it is among the communities for whom the theology is still alive, but those are not for us in, I think you guys are mostly in the US, I'm in Canada, in theory, like Christian theology is not the theory of our state. But the very fact that it's not means that you can look at it saying the quiet part loud and then go and look at the quiet part and go, like, oh, these two things are saying the same thing. Oops. And allows you to look at things like economics as doing theology, not just in the sense of like talking about God, but in the sense of saying, why is it that the world cannot be otherwise than it is? Why is it that you shouldn't even want the world to be otherwise than it is? You can see that in a certain way when you put these two things next to each other. So that's the answer to the more general question. To the more specific question of the Damnation Project, this does kind of relate to these questions around slavery, kind of what's different about the capitalism that emerges from slavery than about the way legitimation may have worked in societies like Anselm's own, where the angels are just metaphors as opposed to people we actually damned. There's a way in which it can say that, and we can't say it to ourselves because we can only talk in euphemisms. There's something about the way in which looking to theology, which doesn't have to speak in euphemisms because it isn't talking about sort of people on the ground, lets you see what is being said in the euphemisms, if that makes sense.
Sean, thank you for coming on the show. I have to admit, I have not read your paper. I'm actually kind of pinch hitting on this episode. And Adam told me to approach it like I'm Larry King. I know nothing. I'm coming in. I'm just asking questions. But fortunately, I think I'm fluent enough in Nietzsche and Deleuze to maybe make an important connection here. Though the one thing that I find most interesting about this conversation so far is the idea, and this wasn't said explicitly, but the idea that theology is somehow either submerged or obfuscated within the economy that we have. And recently, some comments made by the Pope about the nature of hell came to interest me. And in fact, online, somebody had made a sort of creative misreading of it. And if folks don't remember, Pope Francis in 2024 said, I like to think of hell as empty. And I think what he meant was, is that nobody's in hell yet. But I think the more terrifying prospect is that there's nothing in hell at all whatsoever. Because what damnation as an image promises us is an utter continuity between social reproduction as we know it here on Earth and a kind of ongoing punishment, both extensive and maybe more intensive in the afterlife. And so to go to hell and to be promised damnation and to have that promise revealed as not being able to see the creditors to whom you are making these payments, right? And not seeing the suffering of others and not, you know, enjoying the surplus of pleasure in the periphery that we're grabbing, seeing others suffer as well. To me, there's a sort of imaginal connection between what's happening in that particular image of hell and in the economy as we understand it. And just to make the connection to Nietzsche here, I think the fundamental critique of debt itself has to do with the fact that, you know, as Nietzsche says, there is no direct link between suffering, the notion of a creditor, and the compensation of it. But yet, the articulation of this circuit of the creditor-debtor relationship itself becomes the warrant for compensation, and also the warrant maybe to exact more surplus in the form of delivering more suffering, right? And so there's a sort of wheel of samsara thing that kind of happens, you know, when it comes to this notion of debt. And just to bring it back to your very first comments about being involved with Occupy and the notion of debt, whether it's college debt or credit card debt and so forth, once the question of reparations is brought up, you know, this is always a very contentious issue. And I think even as recent as this week, California passed some sort of law or bill, you know, some sort of bill or program went through to actually enact reparations at the state level in a very specific way. I think it had to do with expropriated lands, like in the beach, if I'm not mistaken. But the question of absolving debt, the concept of absolution itself, I think attaches itself or falls back upon the language of debt too. So when it comes to the political issue of approaching debt and alleviating different folks of different kinds of debt or measuring debt, how do we get around the language that's inherent to the discourse itself in such a way as that we don't compound the presupposition of the creditor-debtor relationship every time we talk about it? I think this is fundamentally the issue. So for example, just to make it as concrete as possible, you know, some Marxists might say something to the effect of, well, we should not have reparations, because what would be better is to have the revolution and eliminate the entire system of debt itself, right? But then this raises the question of how, you know, certain distributions of land and how responsibilities might be delegated under a command economy and so forth. So once again, all of those presuppositions come creeping back in. I'm wondering if there's any sort of positive way that you deal with that, either in the paper, in your work, or in your activism, past, present, or future.
Yeah. So big question. And there's a couple kind of packaged in. So one is this kind of question of the relationship between debt and the enjoyment of others' pain, which kind of goes to the Francis comment. Because yeah, people really hated that comment, it was interesting to see who. Because there's this. So one of the interesting things, I don't think Anselm says this, but something you see in like Aquinas and Dante is this idea that like what one of the chief pleasures of heaven is that you get to watch hell. Like this is right there in like the Summa Theologica. Like, you know, what are you doing when you're not just like singing God's praises all day? Well, you're like enjoying the fact that these people are rightly suffering. And so there's something about that's like so kind of necessary to get this thing off the ground. Like it's not just so right. The Nietzsche thing on debt is in some way you have to be somehow there's this connection between this idea of kind of suffering and compensation, but to be able to make someone else able to compensate, there's this question of how do you make someone have to remember what they did to you? and how would you do that if you didn't enjoy doing it? And like, there's a whole thing. So one of the things, I think one of the ways in which I'm a pessimist is I don't think there is like a being together that doesn't do that. Like I don't think there is human society. I have yet to encounter a human society that doesn't work on the logic of debt. If you find one, let me know. That would be like, I would love to, I would love to see how they do. And so that isn't even, so trying to get out of the language of debt isn't even really my thing. Like I think it's interesting that we are so, I think it says something about the structure of the legitimation narratives that we're surrounded by, that we think that we can only hear debt and see the particular apparatus of debt that we are enmeshed in. That there is no, because like you, whether or not you mean this in like a, like I actually think this or in like a, like, playing with the character for a second thing. I do want to see my fucking creditors in hell. Like I do. I just do. And I'm unapologetic about that, actually. Like fuck those guys. Like fuck federal student loans. Like I don't get the fuck out of here. Like fuck like these mortgage lenders. Like I don't
27% interest rates on credit cards.
Yeah, like no, I don't. I don't want to see like a. I'm in fact not invested in the world in which we all forget our debts to one another. I want them to fucking remember what they did. The question is, so the question to me is, how do you think about what a structure of debt that wouldn't look like ours would look like in a way that, like, I think trying to get out of the logic of debt actually doesn't help you do, because then that it actually makes it harder to think about what that would mean, which is why I find thinking about slavery so helpful. Because what's the problem of, like there's a way in which the problem of the slave in a nutshell is this problem of what does it mean to make someone so embody debt in their very being that they have no recourse, that there is no possible upside for them. There's a way in which that question is a live political question that you see running through things like the 2008 financial crisis, where what's going on with those mortgages? Oh, those are like investors, like turning some people into attempting to turn some people into permanent long-term income streams for themselves, and then like failing, oops, but then setting things up such that it's those people who bear the consequences of that failure, not them. So to me, the questions about how you get out of that aren't so much questions about how do you get out of the logic of debt. They're questions of how do you set things up in such a way that no one has no one they can't play. No one doesn't have other claims on themselves that they can't play off against the claims on themselves that they would really prefer not to be engulfed by. Like how do you make it impossible to become like a slave? Because that is not the world we live in. It is not impossible in the world we live in to become like a slave. And this to me is like the kind of central lesson of contemporary Black studies. Like this is why if you want to understand capitalism, you go to Black studies. It's not just because like, oh, you need to understand reparations and stuff. Like that matters. But the question is, there's something about the mechanics of that someone like Sadia Hartman is really turned on to and can kind of flesh out, oh, there's something other than just there are creditors and there are debtors here. There's a way in which credit is an opportunity for some people, and it's like a saddling with something they will never be able to repay for others. And that has something structural at stake that's not just debt or not debt.
If you don't mind, may I ask just one quick follow-up question? So if the question is not about forgetting about the structure of debt or an absolute abolition of debt, perhaps a more modest proposal, which might be returning to or manifesting the kind of society that has more finite or even spongy forms of debt, something like a potlatch, without necessarily fetishizing the sort of primitivist vision of the potlatch. But we still, I think, are forced to admit that we are instituting a quote-unquote system of cruelty, in the sense that insofar as one's obligated to pay a debt, you are you know, ensconced within that system. But at the same time, in a very practical way, what do you see as potential outs or release valves or ways to ease the pressure of a society that's committed to maintaining a certain form of debt so that there's a sense of social cohesion, a sense of economic flow, that there's libidinal lines of flight so that folks don't get hemmed up in their debt to the point they can't do things that they want to do? I mean, is there something that you see historically that you think would work in the present time? You're welcome to grasp onto any of that.
Yeah. So I think something you said that really, I think, helps crystallize the problem in a certain kind of way is this question of finitude, which you connected kind of very briefly, like glancingly in a way that wasn't sure how deliberate this was, to this question of like being able to look at the suffering you're enjoying. There's a way in which, like, I think the structural question is really about the ways we are able to enjoy, well, some of us are able to set up and enjoy certain forms of indebted suffering that then they don't have to look at as something they've done. And that's something that I do think the potlatch is a good example, precisely because there's something so personal about those connections that there's no way to not look like an asshole if you act like an asshole. So the questions are, how do you set things up such that one is forced to be responsible? The two ways I want to kind of think about this in the future, and this is sort of like an ongoing next set of questions for me, have been thinking a lot about Islamic finance, which is sort of predicated on very different questions than Christian financial ethics are, because a lot of kind of the history of Islamic finance is stuff around how do you design a contract in such a way that your upside is always matched by your downside. Like how do you set up like relationships between people such that it's in some sense illegal to saddle other people with your risks? So this is like kind of the live question in contemporary Indonesian banking. I'm not saying that to say that they've figured it out, but I do think it's like something like the right question. There are small scale experiments trying to do things like this. So at Mimbrace, for instance, Colin is currently setting up, like encountered the sort of basic organizational problem of we have a lot of people who need affordable housing and would really rather not be like enriching like a landlord to do that, but also can't buy housing in the current housing market. It turns out that if you're willing to get creative with like the like organizational structures, you can set up things like an LLC that allows you to like pay in your own equity to something the LLC owns such that you can like leave with the, like there are small scale experiments like this that you can do that like Mimbrace adjacent projects have been experimenting with around like, how do you set things up such that your upside is your downside and your downside is your upside? Like somebody, your upside isn't somebody else's downside, if that makes sense. But those are small scale questions. The bigger question is, what would it take to institute things like that on more than just the small circle of people who want them for each other? Like, how do you make it illegal to take advantage of someone else? Like that's a broader question about like legal infrastructure that I don't yet have an answer to, but that it seems like, how do you go from that, those small scale questions, to what kind of society can do that? And it seems to me that like those, yeah. This is trailing off at this point, but hopefully.
Well, no, it's all right. I mean, if I could actually, it's one thing I wanted to pick up on just recently, because of course, as you're talking about contemporary Black studies, I mean, so many more recent texts have focused on exactly this notion of debt, particularly, for example, you know, Denise Ferrer de Silva's Unpayable Debt came out a couple of years back. One of the main influences you have in this paper is Sadia Hartman and her book Scenes of Subjection. And if anything, it seems a little bit like a shift away from sort of a post-salvation, if you want to take it theologically post-salvation, if you want to take it historically post-slavery, in what she calls the afterlives of slavery, in which it seems your description, there's a similar double bind in that the American state, in the way, purchases purchases, quote unquote, this is in their own narrative, of course, it's all narrative, as you're saying, the freedom of its enslaved people, and then in doing so attempts to redeem itself, and then imposes on a new category of unpayable debt, which is in the eyes of the criminal justice system, tends more towards a, like, for example, like fallenness in the sense of criminal liability and the like, in which case slavery is then reimposed. Just to remind all of our non-American, this is that the 13th Amendment did not outlaw slavery. It says, unless you're in prison. That one little caveat I got the first time I read that, I was like, well, that explains everything. But just, yeah, so how can you just explain a bit more sort of how this work from Sadia Hartman on debt feeds into shifting the terrain from the theological to the political, and also maybe how that feeds into not only the wider course you're doing, but also the experiences of different kinds of debtor, debt meaning different things, different people, the experience in terms of some of the questions about race that happened during the Occupy movement.
Yeah, so this, so chapter 5 of Scenes of Subjection is all about this kind of question of, like, post-emancipation, what were people emancipated into? And her answer is indebted servitude. And what she means by that is, like, oh, well, if the kind of national story is that we freed our slaves, then the slaves now owe us their freedom and need to demonstrate that they're capable of it. And there's no way to be done demonstrating that is part of the problem. Once you've said that it's not a given, it's a thing you need to show that you're ready for, there is no being done showing that you're ready for it. And she links this to this kind of question of criminality, which raises this set of questions about, like, what does it mean? So if there's this kind of Nietzschean link between the idea of debt and the idea of responsibility, this idea that, like, what it means to be morally responsible is in some way to be able to pay what one owes, to be able to remember what one owes and pay what one owes. What does it mean to be in a position where you are continually on the hook to demonstrate that you can do that, such that any failure demonstrates that you can't, and any success at best demonstrates that you're, like, on the way? So there's a kind of double bind there. And it's a political double bind in the sense of kind of, like, the legitimation narrative of the modern American state post-emancipation. There's a kind of economic bind there because it's a question of accounting. It's a question of who owes what for who, such that, like, this is why, in some way, this is why reparations is such a thorny question in the U.S. is because it's not, in fact, it would be a real problem for the national narrative if we owed the formerly enslaved for slavery, as opposed to them owing us for freeing them. The kind of accounting in the banal kind of numbers sense and the accounting in a moral sense are actually inseparable, because deciding what is an asset and what's a liability on whose balance sheet you can't actually separate those questions. You can't separate the question of, like, how much money is owed to the families of former slaves from the question of, okay, but, like, what did they give us and what did we give them? And that's a story question. There's no separating those questions. So in some ways, this is kind of the next thing for the Damnation Project as a project, is this question of, like, okay, what is that as a structure? Like if that is a specific form of structure around debt, and that more or less is the structure I'm calling damnation, this structure, this kind of, this position in a system of judgment in which only the bad that you do is something you can be counted responsible for, and the good that you do is always attributable to someone else, such that one can never pay for the other. There's a way in which that's the, you know, that's the problem of the angels. That's also in some ways the problem of the slave. And Hartman kind of shows us that's also the post-emancipation problem of blackness in the Americas, potentially globally. And so this gets us to Fanon, right? Because throughout his work, one of the only kind of consistent through lines is this idea, is the language of damnation, right? Like one of the only things that kind of travels from Black Skin, White Masks to what's translated as Wretched of the Earth, but in French is the Damned of the Earth, is this idea that, as he puts it in the Damned of the Earth, the history, history is the history of men damned by other men. So to my mind, there's like a question about what that even means. It's very easy to say that as like a flowery metaphorical phrase and to use it as an intensifier, like what you have done is what you have done to what Europeans have done to Africans is like damning them in the sense that it's so bad. It's like casting them so outside of, you know, political equality or whatever. But I think something more specific than that is going on in that language, because that double bind is all over Fanon's work as well. Like that double bind problem of like, well, anything good you do is you as a human, and anything else is you as black or you as colonized or you as whatever. Like that separation between to what part of yourself are your acts accountable and how does that fit into a calculus around what you owe and are owed, that is all over Fanon's work in a way that's like, nah, there's something more specific about that language of damnation going on there than just like, oh, you really fucked us over, which you did. We did. That's what happened. But the question is how, what shape does that take? And there's a way in which if you can, my suspicion is that if you can figure out what's specific about that as a kind of problem of moral accounting, then the political and economic calculus changes too in terms of what it would mean to respond to it.
You know, just to, there's so many things I want to ask right now. One, on the one hand, is the inseparability of moral accounting and actual accounting becoming a question of, as I know, and for the viewers, you know, for that edification, you're studying what is value in an Aristotelian sense, and what are the numbers on the balance sheet, and where is their worth is part of this equation, and something that Members is interested in doing. You know, I'm curious about that. I'm curious also, we're having Teja on right shortly, who we had the course Members, What is Blackness? We read Hartman and these other thinkers, and you know, the question of post emancipation is framed by some in this sort of masochistic lens in the language of the contract. And the contract has been brought up a number of times in this discussion so far. You know, so I'm curious, where does masochism become useful? Because we've had a Tiger Liu, Adam's friend, on to discuss, you know, Bataille in the context of masochism versus sadism, right? And maybe to tease us out for what Tej's project is, and because she's coming on to discuss coldness and cruelty as well as her writing. You know, where does that sort of toolkit, if you will, come in to play with your thinking of damnation and, you know, the obvious connections of things like flagellation in theology or the suffering martyr and all these things. There's connections happening there. What's going on with that? And I have further questions still, but yeah, maybe tease us out with something on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so there's kind of two angles there. One is this kind of like if in some sense, there's this link between masochism and the contract in the sense that it's this like, oh, my suffering is something I can do to me, and you can be the means by which I do it. Where there's this kind of, there's a way in which I think the language of contract, and you're right, this is Teja's thinking on this is much more developed than mine, but there's this where the language, where the idea, where tricking oneself into thinking that one is a masochist can be a way of coping with a situation in which one is damned. Because when one is damned, in a certain sense, one is subject to another's sadism. Like there's a very obvious sense in which that's like you thought you could say where this boundary was. Sorry. you never get to. And there's a way in which wanting to be able to say, but we had a contract, is a way of wanting to be able to set the terms for one's own suffering in a way that may not in fact be available. And the question of whether one can kind of psychically handle the inability to be a masochist in that sense is a question that's tied up with the question of, can one handle thinking of oneself as damned long enough to change it? Because there's a way in which it's complicated, because I think it would be wrong to say that it's as simple as there is a psychic economy around the idea that things are getting better for Black people that is masochistic, because that would assume that it is in fact, that would assume a level of ability to self-inflict that is not in fact perhaps what's at stake. So the idea that one has a masochistic relationship to oneself might be an available form of self-soothing. Not only, I refrain from psychoanalyzing Black people. That's Tayshia gets to do that. I'm not going to do it, but is very visible in like ally spaces, right? This idea that America, in some sense, this is the reparations. This is my pessimism about the reparations conversation is why is reparations the thing you want to talk about here, as opposed to structurally making something like this impossible, whether we call that revolution or whether we call that reform. I'm sort of agnostic on the revolution reform question. If we could get a revolution, that'd be great. The question would be then, what do we make with it? and if that's on the table is reform, that's a different question too. But the question of this kind of stance around what we can really do is leverage America's ideas about itself and what those ideas commit it to back at it to say, this is what you owe us, which seems to me to be the primary kind of white ally mode, right? Is to say in either a really obvious, none of us here would do this sense of I really believe in the dream of America. And the dream of America is for Black people, and it just has failed at it. There's a really obvious way that's what are you talking about? That's cope. That's the biggest cope. And it's a cope that's connected to the idea that one can imagine oneself a masochist. One can imagine oneself to be in control of one's suffering such that one could call in the contract, and that the contract is there. Maybe it's not. Maybe there's no contract there, unfortunately. But it shows up in less obvious ways in things like Marxism, where it's maybe it's not America, but maybe the Enlightenment promised us things that it's not delivering us, and we can hold it to its promises in a certain way. Why do you think you can hold it to its promises? Why would you think that? Why would it have a promissory structure in relation to you? It's not even a thing. It's just some guys, they're dead. I'm sorry. So what is that self-soothing doing? Cause that's what that is on some level.
No, I mean, definitely. I think also there's something funny about the idea that most contracts contain within them the acts of resistance that threaten the contract itself. So me not paying my debts back is anticipated by the contract I signed for my student debt, right? All these things, as goes the case for the earlier contracts we see in post-emancipation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Very, very fascinating. Thank you, Sean. Maybe to just because we're over the hour mark now, and maybe to segue into kind of wrapping up the conversation, and we could talk about this for a much longer time. Maybe tease out what's the History of Damnation course for members. How does it fit into the problem space for members? I know you've mentioned kind of Collins thinking on things, but how does History of Damnation, thinking of the larger members project, what of this conversation is in the course? What are we to discuss further? And why should we be excited about that? It's just maybe a good way to wrap up.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways the course is my attempt to give myself an excuse to read the things I would need to read to get at this problem. So it sort of starts from where we talked about today and doesn't stay there. It starts from this idea. We start with Fanon. That's week one is Fanon. And this idea that there is this central metaphor running through his work that might not just be a metaphor, and that he refuses to define for us. And the question of the course is, well, what would it take to be able to say what makes that metaphor available to him? And so to do that, we need to think about what damnation is. So from Fanon, we then jump kind of back in time to Roman law and Indo-European linguistics to think about sacrifice, the gift, and damages, which are kind of the three places that the vocabulary of damnation comes from. It's its legal vocabulary before its theological vocabulary, and its ritual vocabulary before its legal vocabulary. So you might want to call that theological, although it's not Christian yet, obviously. And so there's something going on with the relationship. So we need to think about what's going on with kind of relationships between gift, sacrifice, and the way in which the vocabulary of damnation, which grows up around Roman slavery and the law around Roman slavery, but specifically around the law of like, what do you do? What do you owe when your slave does things, what, like breaks other people's stuff? Because it's not clear that we wouldn't want to say that you did it, but we also wouldn't want to say that the slave was like a full person who did it either. And we need a category for talking about how what is owed is owed, which then kind of spins off into other things. From there, we got to thinking about like, okay, how does this vocabulary make the jump to where we know it from, which is sort of Christian theology. How does the legal vocabulary become theological vocabulary? So thinking about addiction, thinking about ransom metaphors, thinking about kind of questions of accounting for the will. And we kind of end up by the middle of the class around Anselm and the stuff we've been talking about. From there, the question is, well, what happens and how do we get from there to here? Like how do we get from Anselm to us? So we need to think about purgatory, because purgatory is a relatively young theological idea. It seems to have really caught on in the 13th century. And it seems to have caught on to sort of relieve tensions around fears about damnation. And it specifically seems to have caught on around like financial fears about damnation, because one of the drivers of the purgatory doctrine seems to be the idea that like, we don't want to say that usurers are going to hell. But we also need to say that they're responsible for their ill-gotten gains. So what do we do with that? Well, maybe they work them off somewhere. So we need to think about what for whom a doctrine like purgatory is hopeful and why, and where something like that comes from. And then we need to be able to think about how what I'm saying is a structure of judgment. And what I mean by judgment is not just, is something like the overlap between the ability to comprehend what things are and legal judgment, like the ability to render judgment on something. Because I think this is what's at stake for Fanon, and this is what's common to the theological and non-theological uses of damnation. They're about judgment in a certain kind of sense. So how does a theological structure of judgment get secularized? How is it that it's possible to talk about being damned when we're not talking about people going to hell after they die? And so to do that, we need to think about things like the origins of modern international law and slavery and colonialism. We need to be able to think about Hegel, frankly, because we need to be able to think about what it means to say that history judges. And so that's kind of where we end up. In some sense, we end up where we began, because this is a Hegelian metaphor in Fanon. And so we end up right back where we began in Hegel, but maybe with an ability to say what it is that Hegel is saying that we might not have thought he was saying before. So that's kind of the arc. What does it mean to say that history judges, and what are the stakes of that? And if history judges, are some people damned by that judgment, for better and worse?
No, for sure. I mean, and there's, you know, there's so many things to talk about. I mean, bringing like what is the relation of property, and maybe how all these thinkers think of property
and personalities.
And yes, and how, you know, just I'm thinking of just like how you frame it as, you know, property relations overriding filial relations, you know, problems of kinship that members is so concerned with being a centerpiece of how, you know, what's at stake here. There's a lot going on. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Oh, well, because there's a way in which the problem has to do with, the idea I'm kind of currently toying with in both the Aristotle stuff I've been doing separately and in thinking about the damnation class is like, part of the problem, like property and personality are kind of historically the same problem in Western thought. And they're both problems about the will in a certain kind of way, because property is a problem about what does it mean to say a thing is mine, and personality is a problem about what does it mean to say that I am mine, both of which revolve around the question of what does it mean to say that what I do is mine? Like, what does it mean to say my acts are my acts? And does it take denying some people ownership of their own actions in order to coherently say that mine are mine? Like Aristotle says, yes. Hegel says no. Can Hegel say no consistently? Not sure. But this is kind of the thing, is what does it mean to say that the things I do, I did them? Property is in some sense tied up with that, and personality is in some sense tied up with that, in part because I so obviously depend on things that aren't me. My property is so obviously not just mine. Like anybody who's owned a building, which is not me, by the way, probably never will, knows that you do not, in fact, owning a building does not mean you get to say what happens on your property, or that like owning a building exposes you to all kinds of like other people's claims and like ways of being hemmed in by the fact that you can't do this with your property because you're zoned this way, and like your neighbor has an interest in your property for various reasons, and like blah blah blah. Like there's no such thing as individual, like that's, individual ownership is like a pure theoretical fiction. Like it's not a thing. And so given that it's not a thing, what does it take to say that it's a thing? What's at stake in being able to tell ourselves the story that we're doing it? And what do we have to do to make it look like we can say that? Like that's.
Definitely. But again, thank you, Sean, for coming on. I mean, Adam, Craig, closing remarks.
I just want to say thanks, Sean. This is always an interesting topic to me, especially my first entry point to even considering the creditor-debtor relationship is of course, Nietzsche and the genealogy of morals. And I think that the research that you're touching upon is really the very essence of the prospect of envisioning a new society, insofar as that we think that's an important political project, you know, post-revolution or in the now. So yeah, definitely a lot of food for thought here. And I love the connection to damnation.
Yeah. I mean, I think speak for all soon. We say, you know, God damn Hegel. We can't live with him, can't live without him. And, so yeah, Sean, thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing this paper, of course. And hopefully we can link some of your work in the description. Of course, the work of Members School. And of course, coming around March, I believe, we are having Taija Mars McDougall on to talk about her own work in Black Studies, particularly linked up with coldness and cruelty, the idea of contract, and the return to, of course, the work of Leopold von Sacher Masoch and G. Deleuze. And on that note, I'd like to say, Sean, thanks again for coming on, and we'll catch everyone later.